Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon with an open phone line that you can call if you have questions you'd like to ask about the Bible or the Christian faith, or if you have a different viewpoint you'd like to balance comment with. You can call me at the number I'm about to give, but I'm also going to let you know in advance the lines are full. You won't get through if you call right this moment, but you probably will if you call somewhat later in the broadcast, so have this number ready. 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. All right, our first caller today is Rez in Novato, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Rez. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. How you doing, bud?
Good. Thanks.
Good. I just hope people continue to keep president in prayer, because if Biden gets in, we're all headed for boxcars. So, anyways, I just want to say that. The other thing is I just had a comment and then kind of a question. And my comment was, I think the older that I get, I think that I don't necessarily believe in, say, universalism, but I think there's going to be a lot more people that are going to be saved than not saved. And I say this because I'm 46 years old, and as I've been working through a lot of my problems, I realize that a lot of the things that were inflicted on me in the way that I treat other people are because of your parents, and the way they act is because of their parents. And so a lot of people just operating on almost like a default setting. And, you know, and I think what Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I know in my case, I really, you know, don't know what I've done until I continue to just evaluate my life. So wanted to say that and maybe get your thoughts about that. And then the other thing I wanted to say was, if all men are created in the image of God, which I believe the Father and the Son are one, that means to me that the spark of Christ is in all men, every man, even Muslims, Buddhists, people of, you know, even Aborigine tribes, but maybe they don't know it. And I wondered if by somehow accepting Christ as our Lord and Savior, if that spark that Christ created in everybody now becomes activated. Because if we're all created in his image, and all men are, do we even need to tell people about Jesus? And if we do, is it just to kind of wake them up and remind them that Christ that's in them from birth is going to be activated? And that's kind of the best way I thought to put that.
Okay, well, some of the things you've mentioned, I don't know that I'd be in a position to answer yay or nay, because some of it's not really found in the Bible. There is something maybe a little similar to some of that found in John chapter 1 verse 9, where it speaks of Jesus as the true light who gives light to every man who comes into the world. So it's basically saying that Jesus gives light to every man that comes into the world, and that he is that light that enlightens every man that comes into the world. So there is some light in all people, whether it's because we are made in the image of God, as we certainly are, or whether it's because God has put a conscience in people, or he's simply committed himself to communicating with people, and therefore there's some degree to which he's given a measure of revelation of himself to people. It may be little more than the awareness that there must be a God out there. It may be little more than the awareness that some things are right and wrong, and that any thinking person would realize if some things are right or wrong, they must have been determined to be right or wrong by someone above us. I mean, anyone who thinks clearly would know those things, and therefore probably a lot of people who have never heard of the Bible, never heard of any religion possibly, or maybe they've heard of other religions, but they haven't heard of Christ, you know, they might have some light that we don't know about. Because if Jesus is the one who gives light to everyone who comes into the world, then we have to assume that everyone who comes to the world has some light, and that, and as it says in John 1:9, that light is Christ. So their response to that light would be, in a sense, a response to Christ, even if they didn't know who he was, because he is that light. And if they shun the light, like John chapter 6 says people do, they light comes into the world and they hate the light, so they hide in darkness. Well, then that's their reaction to Christ, even if they've never heard of Christ. And if they, you know, love light, if they seek the light and they're desirous to be more enlightened, that's a positive response, I would think, to the light, which if God counts that light to be Christ, then it's hard to know exactly how that factors into the possibility of their salvation. But you did ask, you know, if everyone has some little bit of light in them, do we really need to tell people about Jesus? Well, we need to tell people about Jesus because the light of nature is not enough to really tell them everything we know about Jesus. Well, they may not even know that Jesus has come to the earth. They may not know that Jesus died for us, that he rose again, that he's enthroned and he's the ruler of the universe and he commands all men everywhere to submit to him. Those things are not necessarily things that you'd gain by simply having a basic knowledge of conscience or of the there must be a God or something like that. Those things are important things. And that's what the gospel is. And we preach that gospel to them so that they'll know it and become a part of it. Now, when I say a part of it, I'm not necessarily talking about heaven per se. I believe in heaven, and I believe that Christians and who knows, maybe some others may end up there. I don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us who all will end up in heaven and who won't, but we know that we who follow Jesus will. People who follow the light they have and never heard of Jesus, we don't have any specific information given to us about that. But I would say that even if we could say, well, some people could go to heaven, even if they've never heard about Jesus, if we took that approach, it would still be no argument against preaching the gospel, because for people to go to heaven is not what Jesus came for. Jesus came to establish a kingdom over which he reigns and to recruit into his kingdom his, you know, followers. And so even if a person, let's say, goes his whole life ignorant of Jesus, but because they followed the little light they had, God, you know, gives them some kind of a break and he doesn't send them to hell. I mean, if that's the case, it would still be that they had missed their one opportunity on earth to serve the interests of God in this planet, which is where his interests are. I mean, he made the planet and he put people in charge of it, and his desire is that people would have dominion over it. And so they failed, and therefore Jesus came to rescue that and recreate things, as it were, create a new kingdom where he's the head, and he wants all men to be part of that. Now, if people end up in heaven but were never a part of that, then maybe they've dodged a bullet, but God hasn't gotten from them what he made them for. He hasn't had them members of Christ's body serving in the world, doing Christ's work in the world, which was what the body of Christ is here for. They've lived without knowledge of, you know, Christ, so they can't really escape their demons or even the sin in their life. Jesus saves from that. You know, the idea that Jesus might or God might forgive people for something he sees in them that we don't know is there, is that's his business. But our business is to make sure everyone knows that Jesus is the king and that he is recruiting all people to be part of his kingdom, part of his body, and to do his work in the world, to rescue the world. And so if we don't preach to these people, they'll never be part of that. And while even if they manage to get to heaven somehow because of the mercy of God, God will have failed to receive what he wants from them. And what he wants from us is holiness and loyalty and obedience and service. And that's what he made us to do. And it's a shame if God doesn't get what he made us for, because he deserves it. I appreciate your call. John in Massachusetts, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Can you hear me okay?
Sure.
Okay, I have two questions for you, and I'll ask them, and then I'll get off the air. So my first question is, if communion was so different in the early church, when I'm reading about it in 1 Corinthians, it seems like it's kind of more like a potluck thing. How is the way we do it today justified? And then my second question is, James mentions that we will be judged by the law of liberty. Can you explain what the law of liberty is and why freedom isn't oppressive in Christianity? You know, a lot of philosophers have mentioned that we are condemned to be free and that freedom is actually quite oppressive, the ability to choose. So why is freedom a good thing in Christianity, and what is that law of liberty?
All right. Yeah, I'd be glad to talk about that. You are right. I believe that the way they did communion in the Bible is considerably different than the way it is usually done in churches today. Usually in churches today, it is a brief interlude in the general worship service where people take a little tiny sip of wine or grape juice and take a little tiny piece of bread. And it's all ritualistic. It's all symbolic. It represents the body and blood of Christ. In the early church, as we know from reading 1 Corinthians 11, they were actually having a meal. And we know this also from the church fathers and what they said about the Agape Feast. The main fellowship of the church in the apostolic times and shortly thereafter for the next century or so, was not primarily a lecture service in an auditorium. It was table fellowship at a meal. And that's obvious, again, from reading 1 Corinthians 11, but it's also obvious from reading what the church fathers say. Even Jude mentions the false teachers who have come in and invaded your agape feasts. So the Christian gathering was more like a meal than it was, like a meeting. But there was teaching in their lives, of course. As far as we know, they were taught every day, at least in the early church. And, of course, we can be taught every day, too. Now we have a lot of opportunities for that. But as far as eating together, that's the real specialness about getting together as Christians. And it was, the communion, therefore, was a meal that was the center of their meetings. Their meetings also, had some teaching, had some, I'm sure, some prayer and some singing, but it was the eating together, not a symbolic eating necessarily, but an actual full meal, and that full meal was done also in remembrance of Christ. It may well be, and we're not told this specifically, but we're not told otherwise either. It may well be that at that meal they interrupt the meal briefly to hold up a cup and hold up a piece of bread and say, now let's eat this in the memory of Jesus' blood and his body. They might have done that, or they might have just simply regarded the whole meal. Every piece of bread they put in their mouth, every sip of wine they took was to be a time of remembering what Christ had done for them on the cross. There's much that we're not told. That's the problem. The New Testament tells us very, very little about the communion meal. And what it does tell us is pretty much contrary to the way we practice it in most churches today. As far as the church fathers go, they tell us somewhat more, but we don't have very many testimonies in the early church to the protocol of a meeting, for example, and how things were done. And I think, in fact, some of those things even changed a bit over time. I'm not really sure that they would insist upon a particular protocol. They just obviously did it one way instead of another. You asked if the modern way we do it, it could be considered legitimate. I would say it could be considered legitimate. I'd much rather do things the way they did it in the New Testament. I don't think there's a legalism about it in the Bible, that you have to have it just this way. But if you don't have it at a full meal, of course, you're missing some dynamics that they considered to be important. There's not much told. I do have a lecture on it, on the Eucharist and communion, somewhere on my website, and I go into it in detail. Now, your other question was about James calling the law of liberty, which is the law of love, the law to love your neighbor as you love yourself, what we follow the law of liberty. And he called it that because in keeping God's standards, we do so happily because we have love in our hearts that the Holy Spirit puts in there. And God's standards simply are all simply the outworking of love. So if you have love in your heart, that then you want to serve and do good. That's what your heart tells you to do. And when you get to do what your heart tells you to do, that's liberty. Now, philosophically, we might say, oh, but there's a great burden on those who have liberty because they have responsibility. Well, that's true. God apparently felt we could handle that. It's true animals don't have any responsibility before God, apparently. But we do, because we can make choices and we're responsible to make the right choices. Is it oppressive? Well, I don't think so. Not if you want to do good. If you don't want to do good, I think it's pretty oppressive. But if you don't want to do good, you're not a Christian anyway. So why? Who cares? Just do your thing and live with the consequences in the next life or whatever. But I mean, if a person wants to do good, and anyone who doesn't is not really converted, then they get to do good. It's not so burdensome. It says in 1 John chapter 5, this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and they are not burdensome. I don't see it as such a burden. True, there is a burden of responsibility on mankind in general. And those who hate God, which is perhaps maybe the majority, they must find it very burdensome that they have to make choices and suffer consequences for them. But those who want to please God, they want to make the choices that please God. And that's what God requires. So it's not really such a burden, in my opinion. I don't find it to be so, but some may. I don't think real Christians generally would. Steve in Lakewood, Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. I have two questions I want to ask you, and then I'd like to make a major announcement, if you'll let me indulge that. My first question is, and I suppose I could look it up online and do my own research, but I've been getting in the habit of the last few Sundays listening to a program similar to yours called The Bible Answers Live, hosted by two Seventh-day Adventists, namely Doug Batchelor, whom you debated about the Sabbath. And anyway, a few Sundays ago, he fielded a question about preterism, and he told the caller that not many people believe in preterism, and basically said it was heretical, but he never really distinguished between partial preterism and full preterism. And so I think he was only referring to full preterism when he was saying all this. But didn't he point out correctly that most people believe in dispensationalism or futurism, but that he and his colleague, Gene Ross, believed in something called historicism, and he said that that model of revelation is what makes the most sense, that is the way to go. My question is stemming from something he said. First of all, he said, first, when he was answering that question about preterism, he was only talking about full preterism. So is it possible that he might not even know about partial preterism? But would you say that more people believe in partial preterism than historicism or not? And isn't the partial preterism paradigm growing rapidly?
Okay, well, let me address that before you go to your next question. I don't know if Doug Batchelor is familiar with the nuances of different preterist views. To say that only a few people believe in preterism, I would say that's fairly true of the full preterism. But when it comes to a partial preterism, I think that that's a very dominant view. It's not as popular as dispensationalism, certainly. But I mean, it's certainly it's a fast growing view, but it's also a view that's got respectable leaders for the past couple centuries who've thought that that's the best way to look at the Book of Revelation. As far as historicists, there used to be a lot of historicists. Most Protestants used to be historicists, but ever since the late 19th century, other views of Revelation have been predominant, and now there's not very many historicists. The Seventh-day Adventists are historicists. There may be other groups that are, but I don't know very many. So I would say that historicism and preterism are both minority views in today's church. However, historicism did have a lot of proponents, especially from the time of the Reformation until about the early 20th century. So even though not many people are historicists now, there have been times where it was the predominant view. Now, I don't know if there is ever a time when preterism was the predominant view. So it may be that throughout history, there's been more historicists than preterists. I can't say. I don't know. Nor do I care. I mean, if we're concerned about counting noses to determine what's true, then we'd have to reject both preterism and historicism, which I'm sure dispensationalists would like for us to do, but we don't decide truth on that basis. What's your second question?
My second question is, first of all, I'd like to read a scripture and then get your response. But for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, and after their own lust shall heap to themselves teachers, having itching ears, and they shall turn away their ears from the truth, and shall be turned away, and shall be turned unto fables. And that was 2 Timothy 4:3-4. Steve, you have been fielded many questions about the Sabbath, but I just want to officially ask you, for the record, you have used with your whole heart, mind, and soul, and are willing to do anything that God demands. If you really thought that Sabbath keeping was part of the Christian curriculum, you'd do it in a heartbeat, wouldn't you? You aren't doing it because you are trying to get out of doing something that the law requires. You just know that it is not a requirement of the Christian, so you choose not to. And legalism is just as bad as lawlessness, is it not?
It could well be. Well, certainly I would do whatever I believe the Bible says to do. I mean, that's what I've devoted my whole life to doing. I've never understood quite Doug Batchelor's view on this. When he and I debated, he kept referring to people who don't keep the Sabbath, but who keep the other 9 of the 10 commandments, as trying to get a 10% discount, he said, off keeping the law. Well, frankly, if I was going to give myself a 10% discount, there's other laws in there I'd give myself the discount on and keep the Sabbath, because Sabbath keeping's easy. You know, it means sit around, just sit around, read the Bible. I do that every day anyway, so I don't mind doing that on Saturdays, you know. So, I mean, no, I'm not trying to avoid keeping Sabbath because somehow it's distasteful or that it's, you know, too much work or too little work or whatever. I never understood why he thought people would try not to keep the Sabbath simply because they wanted to avoid keeping the law. I mean, there's certainly other laws that are more of an imposition, or would be on me, certainly, than keeping Sabbath would be. But no, I mean, you can't really judge somebody's heart about something like that. Of course, I would keep the Sabbath if I had any reason to believe the Bible required it. But yeah, Doug Batchelor makes it sound like it's a hard thing to do, and that people are giving themselves a cut in the cost of being a Christian when they cut out the Sabbath requirement. Like that's a hard thing, and you know, I'm going to take the easy way, so I won't keep the Sabbath. How could it be taking the easy way to rest on Saturdays? That's not, I don't understand that thinking on his part.
Okay, well, I would like to make the announcement on myself this time officially on the air, if you don't mind, but I'd like to talk about the Matthew713.com website. And I want to talk as if I'm talking to your listeners and not you, okay?
Okay, but before you do, let me just tell our listeners who know nothing about it. Matthew713.com is a website that this brother works on, and some other people work on it too. And it takes radio calls from this program and puts them in a topical index and does a lot of other things too. So go ahead and tell us more about it, Steve.
Yes. So a lot of you should know about the Matthew 7:13 website. Now it's been on a link on the Narrow Path website for about a year now, but we've been working on this for 2 years, and I just want to let you know that there's two ways you can access the questions. The first way is by the date of the show, and just scroll through the questions and find them that way. And then the second way is there's a brand new topic index that has just been working for about the last 6 months, where you can find any subject just about and go to that question, and go to that topic and find a whole bunch of questions on that topic. Now, what I really want to emphasize, though, because nobody really knows this, even people who have been sharing this on Facebook for a long time, in their Facebook group for a long time, you can share individual questions. So any question that you really, really like and you want, and people say they have this fear of witnessing or evangelizing, you can share an individual question and have people say, listen to this and get back to me and tell you what you think about it, and be able to witness to them that way. And the way you do that is by going to the date of the question section and hit go to individual call and just paste that URL address and send it anyway, however you contact people. And unfortunately, you can't do that when you're in the topic mode, but eventually it will be changed, I've been told, by Jeremy White, who also created the website. But I just want you to know that you can share individual questions, and that's pretty important to me. A whole bunch of people on Facebook did not even know you could do that. I just want to let people know that.
Okay, thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. And I think Steve told me before there's like, I think there's over 10,000 questions indexed there, which is a pretty amazing feat. He's been working really hard on it. My wife also works on that website somewhat, and this other man that he mentioned is also there's it's a group of people, actually three people, who live in very different places, far from each other, who are cooperating on that website. That's Matthew 7:13. And by the way, people often write to me and ask if they can get the notes for my lectures on something or another. Well, the notes are all posted there at Matthew 7:13. All the notes for my lectures that are available that I could send you are there also. I'm going to take a break here, but we have another half hour coming up. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We are a listener-supported ministry. That means we don't have commercials or sponsors or anything else. We don't take any commercial breaks in the whole hour we're on the air. But we do have to pay for radio time. So if you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. That other website is Matthew7:13.com. Ours is thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Stay tuned.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. We're proud to welcome you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the archives of all the radio shows. Study, learn, and enjoy. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you'd like to be on the program, you can call this number, 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Ian from Tallahassee, Florida. Ian, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. Are you turned down strangely quietly today? Because I can barely hear you even on speakerphone to my ear.
Well, my volume on my unit is turned all the way up, as it is every day. So I don't know if things are different at the studio. I'm not at the studio, but
I can't sing. That's clearer now. I just had a quick sort of comment for John, who has called in a few times from the Frisco, Texas area, and then mm-hmm. I had a quick question for you from Second Chronicles 21:12. I just wanted to say I lived in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for about 2 years, and I was originally from the Portland area, and I'll say that the political, in my opinion, the political realm plays a big part, much bigger part in Dallas. And so sometimes it's tricky to find a church that feels more Bible-centered without some strange or seemingly extraneous cultural influences. But depending on what kind of service style he's looking for, I've had really good experiences with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and that's their densest amount of churches is in that metroplex. And then I would definitely listen to sermons before going to a place in one particular case, but I do know the Episcopal Diocese of Dallas, as well as the Anglican Church in that area, they have taken a stand for biblical views on marriage and the Bible and the like. So he might look into those. But
okay. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of churches like that around the country. I know he was, for those who don't know, John from Frisco, who has called a few times. He has struggles with same-sex attraction, and he's looking for
he's
looking for fellowship in that area where he, I think, where he won't feel too judged or suspected or whatever. But now, by the way, Matthew 7:13.com, which we mentioned a moment ago, it also has kind of a listing that people can add to it of fellowship options in different geographical areas. And I don't know how many are there at this point. It's kind of a new feature, but anyone who has a fellowship that they highly recommend and that would be perhaps likable or amenable to the kind of people who listen to this show certainly can post it out there at Matthew 7:13 for the help of others. Okay, so what is your question today?
Sure. 2 Chronicles 21 talks about Jehoshaphat's son Joram reigning, and it mentions in verse 12 Elijah sending a letter to King Joram, and I know that various theologians have dealt with this different ways, but I'm curious if it's if you think it might mean Elisha, since Elisha would have been alive at this time, but not Elijah, and since 2 Chronicles also has the typo of 8 years for Jehoiakim instead of 18 years, and so I wasn't sure how you dealt with I was just thinking that might be a possibility, but I was just curious how you deal with Elijah there.
Sure. Well, it is a big problem. I mean, with 2 Chronicles, in that it has Elijah the prophet writing a letter after Elijah had left the earth, because he was gone at this time. So there's been a number of suggestions, and the one you made is not an impossible solution, that it could be a typographical error made or a scribal error made somewhere along the line, and that it was originally Elisha. That is very possible. Other suggestions have been, and I'm not saying that all of these are equally plausible or equally respectable, but some have thought that Elijah might have written a letter to Joram prophetically before he went up, and that the letter was then delivered to him after Elijah's departure. To me, that doesn't seem very likely, so I wouldn't necessarily take that view. Some have thought, well, maybe there's a different Elijah the prophet who lived also, that we, because there's lots of prophets who are unnamed, maybe more than one was named Elijah, but that doesn't seem likely either, because the way he's introduced sounds like it'd be the well-known Elijah the prophet. One thing is that Chronicles doesn't mention Elijah or Elisha elsewhere as the books of Kings do, although it covers the same period of history. Elijah and Elisha ministered in the northern kingdom, and Chronicles only covers the southern kingdom's history. And so Chronicles, unlike Kings, though covering the same time period, doesn't even talk about the ministries of Elijah and Elisha, but here. And that makes it very interesting that there would be such a such a statement here. And it could easily be one of those things, of which we know there are many, where a scribal error has changed one word for a very similar word by accident. And Elijah and Elisha could well be, the names could have been switched here, and that would resolve the problem. But again, the problem is chronological. Elijah was taken up in a whirlwind before the time of this king, but and therefore that this king would receive a letter from his strange. Now, I will say this, and this would not be a mainstream view, and I don't hold it, but I've heard it suggested that, when Elijah was taken up, the Bible doesn't say what happened to him after he was taken up. And some of the sons of the prophets thought that he might have landed somewhere, because they sent out a team, a search and rescue team, after he went up, to see if they could find him, and they didn't find him. But it's interesting that it was not entirely settled in the minds of the witnesses whether he was taken up permanently into heaven or whether he was just carried away by a whirlwind somewhere and dropped off. And there has been at least one suggestion I've heard that Elijah was still on earth, that he had been taken up, but he'd been carried away to some other place, and that he wrote a letter from there. So, I mean, there's at least three or four different suggestions. To me, not knowing which one is true, or if there's a fourth one that I don't know about, I think the idea of a textual corruption through a copyist is probably the best suggestion.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
I appreciate it, Steve. Thank you so much.
All righty, and thank you for your call. Good talking to you. Marie in Sacramento, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. Yes, my question has to do with the crossing of the Red Sea and the location of Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb.
Uh-huh.
I saw a DVD film, a documentary, and there's some new research since 2000 by Dr. Leonard Moeller. And he's a medical research scientist and a marine biologist from Stockholm, Sweden. And it has to do with the part of Exodus chapter 14 when God tells Moses to have the people turn back, and they take a detour of about 18 miles on this dry riverbed, and they go to a place called Pi Hahiroth. And the documentary put this forth as meaning the mouth of the gorges. And so there's a location on the Bay of Aqaba where there's a tiny peninsula and a beach that's formed by the runoff from this dry riverbed, sand and rock, and that's supposedly where this huge group of people were caught between these huge mountains and the Red Sea, which is still the Red Sea, the Yam Suf, even though it's the bay, the Gulf of Aqaba. And they also based some of their findings on deep sea dives and sending a camera, a remote-controlled camera down in the depths, and they found a ridge that extended from this beach almost clearly across to the other side, and then there was another ridge on that side which made the depth of the water a lot less, although it was quite deep. And they found artifacts at the floor of this gulf that resemble chariot wheels. And I was, it's very convincing because...
yeah, I've seen treatments of that. I don't know if I've seen the same one you've seen, but I've seen that presentation more than once from different sources.
Oh,
yeah, and, you know, it is fairly convincing. There may be a few problems with it, but not as many, it seems to me, as there are with traditional ideas. You know, if you can picture the geographical region there, Arabia is separated from the main body of Egypt by a triangular piece of land, which is a peninsula, and it's called the Sinai Peninsula today.
Oh, yes, of course.
And that's where people traditionally have thought that the Israelites wandered for 40 years, and where they think that the Mount Horeb or Sinai is in that Sinai Peninsula. Now, they would have the Israelites then crossing the Red Sea in the Gulf of Suez or somewhere above that. Of course, the Red Sea really is more properly in Hebrew the Sea of Reeds, although we have a sea called the Red Sea, but it's called in Hebrew it's the Sea of Reeds that they crossed, and we don't know where it is, but traditionally it's been kind of associated with that branch of the Red Sea that is we call the Gulf of Suez. Now the triangular peninsula is flanked on the north by the Mediterranean Sea, and on the west by the Gulf of Suez, and on the east by the Gulf of Aqaba, and so this new theory is that they didn't cross the Gulf of Suez or anywhere over there. They crossed the Gulf of Aqaba into Arabia. Now, I've seen the claim that there are chariot wheels. I've seen the pictures of them. Oh. I'd have to say you kind of, in some ways, have to use your imagination to see a chariot wheel there because they're all covered up with coral and things like that, and it's kind of, you know, the shape is not exact, but you could kind of see it. But, yeah, I've heard there's a land bridge there. So I've heard all the things you've said. I think while I can't say, because I haven't studied it like some of these people who make it their specialty have, it strikes me as a very reasonable argument because Paul said in Galatians 4 that Mount Sinai is in Arabia.
Yes, I was just going to share that. But
yeah, and Arabia is not the Sinai Peninsula. Arabia is across the Gulf of Aqaba from there. And therefore, It's in another country outside of Egypt and outside of Sinai Peninsula. But the reason I would say that it also makes more sense that they would have crossed into Arabia across the Gulf of Aqaba is because if Paul said that's where the Mount Sinai is, and by the way, there are some photographs of a mountain over there that looks like it could be Mount Sinai, and there's some other artifacts of former campgrounds and stuff at the foot of the mountain, which
it
could be.
It was blackened at the top, they said.
Yes, it was like it had been burned, right. And so, I mean, that's to my mind, that's a good candidate for the real Mount Sinai. And Moses, of course, was in Midian, which is Arabia, when he was tending the sheep of his father-in-law. And while he was tending the sheep, he went to Mount Sinai to graze them, and that's where he met God. Now, it's hard to believe he would have crossed the Gulf of Aqaba with his sheep to get into the Sinai Peninsula, to get to Mount Sinai there in the traditional spot. It's much more likely that if he was a shepherd in Midian, then the mountain where he was shepherding sheep is probably in Midian too, which is modern Arabia. So, you know, I think that theory has merit. I wouldn't die for it. But to my mind, it seems to fit a lot of things a little better than the traditional view. The main problem with it is that in a very short time, the Israelites had to cross this whole landmass that we call the Sinai Peninsula. And, you know, I've measured before. I forget how far it is they'd have to go, but it's quite some distance. With sheep and livestock and children and so forth, they'd have to be moving really fast to get across there in the few days that they had to do it. But not necessarily impossible.
Well, the documentary said that it was like a three-week trip and that it was the same trade route that Moses had fleed from Pharaoh on.
Uh-huh.
And it was on the Sinai Peninsula above where the mountains are, so yeah. Higher up. And there's a mountain pass there where they turned down along Suez and then came into the center. And it also emphasized that they traveled day and night because of the pillars of fire and a cloud that was with them. They were able to travel longer and because they could see. And then also when Jethro, his father-in-law, comes to help Moses because of all the dilemma of dealing with people and tells him to delegate, that mountain is where Jethro lived there in Midian.
Right. So, I mean, I hear you. So, to me, it's a very good theory. I don't know of any, you know, mortal flaws or lethal flaws in the theory. So, I would say, I kind of lean toward it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay, Marie. Thanks for your call. God bless.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, John in Lake County, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Yeah. Can you hear me, Steve?
Yes, yes, very well.
Okay, yeah, you're breaking in and out. I don't know why. Maybe it's my end. Listen, I have twofold question, one in particular, and if we have time, the second one. I tend to lean to be, there's two views, Calvinism and Arminianism, and I tend to lean towards the Arminian view. And one of the scriptures I point out, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have the Bible with me, but I had a little time from work. And it was that wide is the gate, and many will go through it, and few will find it. Will go through, and few will find it. Right now, the fact that few will find it implies that there's some kind of effort going on the individual's part, because if God has predestined somebody, there's no reason to find it. I mean, is that a good argument?
Well, since I'm not a Calvinist, it sounds like a good argument to me. I think they would say, well, the fact that God predestined people doesn't mean that he didn't also predestine the means. You know, they'd say God doesn't only predestine the ends, but also the means, and that God's will is that some people find it through searching, you know, and so forth.
But it does seem to imply that there's some kind of effort going on in the individual. What I get concerned about Calvinism is, and I think you brought it up, right, is the fact that there's nothing we could do to change it. If you're going to be saved, whether you want it, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You're going to be saved. And that really bothers me. I've always been bothered by that.
Yeah, well, it bothers me a little too. Now, they would say, well, no one's going to be saved who doesn't want to be, because in the process of saving people, God regenerates them. God unilaterally changes their heart. But that doesn't change the fact that before he did that, in their view, they were haters of God, because all people, in their view, are haters of God until they're regenerated. So that means that they were people who did not want God by definition. If they were totally depraved by Calvinistic definitions, that means they're haters of God. And therefore, for him to unilaterally regenerate them and change their mind, that's taking somebody against their will and changing their mind, like you might if you drugged somebody and made them compliant. You know, I mean, the Calvinists hate it when I use this illustration, but I have to say, as much as I have understood the Calvinism by talking to them, reading them, and debating them, their view amounts to God taking somebody who hates him and unilaterally making them love him. And is that much different than a guy giving a girl, a roofie? I mean, she doesn't want him. She doesn't want him when she's in her own state of mind. But if he can do something against her will that forces her to change her mind, well, then she's willing.
I've always had that problem. I've always thought that there's two sides. Yes, God can predestine somebody because of his foreknowledge, okay, because he's the ultimate, the beginning and the end. But there's got to be some kind of effort on an individual that is free will, where you have your own volition to either
accept or reject.
Well, I'll tell
you what,
anything else.
Yeah. This whole subject is, of course, a very large and long-standing debate, and therefore, you know, we can't really cover it now in the few minutes we have here. I would suggest you go to my website, thenarrowpath.com, and look under the tab that says Topical Lectures. And there you'll find a lot of lectures of mine that on everything, but there's a set of lectures called God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation. And it's all about Calvinism and Arminianism, and it's very thorough. It's quite a few lectures, and it goes through all the points of Calvinism and all the scriptures they use and all that. And I think that I'm not a Calvinist, so it's going to come out not on the side of Calvinism, but it will get to the conclusions without neglecting any argument or any scripture that the Calvinists make. That's at my website, thenarrowpath.com, and the lecture series at the Topical Lectures tab is God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation. So I just suggest, if that's an interesting topic to you, you might want to go there. Okay, let's talk to June in Lewis, California. Hi, June. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I have never really researched tithing. I've just thought it was 10%, and then there are other places that you want to donate. And I'm blessed to have some money that I can do both with now, and I had kind of made my mind how I wanted to go, and a friend said they are very definitely different things, tithing as opposed to and or donations, and so that's caused me to rethink, and so I'm wondering your take on it.
Okay, well, my take is this: a tithing is in fact different than donating. But tithing is not a New Testament practice. It's an Old Testament practice. Tithe means tenth. And God told Israel that they needed to support the Levites who worked in the tabernacle and in the temple by bringing a tenth of their produce each year in the harvest time and bringing it to the temple, and that would become the food for the Levites. Now, that practice was never recommended in the New Testament. That is not recommended for Christians. It's true that Jesus mentioned that the Pharisees, who were not Christians, and they were Jews, that they had paid their tithes and they had done well to do so. Some people think, well, see, therefore Jesus tells us that we should do it. No, he told the Pharisees that they should do it because they were Jews. They weren't his followers. They weren't Christians. Jesus never told his followers to ever give 10%. Instead, he told us to be generous, to help the poor. And to a few people, he said, sell all that you have and give to the poor. But the idea in Christianity is we don't own 90% and God gets 10. God owns 100% and we steward it or we manage it for him. And so the way that all of our money is used is to be done to the glory of God. Now, obviously, supporting your family, supporting the church you attend and things like that, those would be consistent with glorifying God. But so is the helping of poor people. If you send money to some ministry that does good to starving children in Haiti, that's as much a gift to God as it is if you give it to the church. There's nothing in the Bible that ever mentions the local church, by the way. What we call local churches are not found in the Bible. In the Bible, the local church was all the Christians in a town. Nowadays, a local church, or what we call local church, is one 501c3 on one corner of a town that operates totally without respect to the interests of another 501c3 two blocks down, and likewise throughout the whole town. Those kinds of 501c3 churches didn't exist in the Bible. The church is simply the fellowship of all those who are truly Christ's followers, and all the followers of Christ in one town are a single church, and all the followers of Christ in the whole world are a single church. So if you're giving to Christians around the world to meet the needs of missionaries, let us say, or ministries that operate around the world or even in the nation, anywhere, if it's a worthy ministry, you're giving to God. If you help the poor, if they're worthy of it, that is to say, if they're not, scam artists or something claiming to be poor, well, that's giving to God. So there's nothing in the Bible that says you should take 10% and give it to your local church, since the Bible knows nothing about local churches as we know them today, nor does it say anything about Christians tithing. The fact that almost every pastor teaches that you should pay a tithe to your local church, when the Bible doesn't have a word about it, ought to raise some suspicions of what motivates that teaching. But I'm not against pastors. I'm just against them not teaching the truth. And that is something that is not the truth. Your money all belongs to God. And someday we'll all stand before God and say, so let's bring out the ledger and see how you used my money. Oh, you used it for you? I thought you were supposed to use my money for me. And that's how the Christian needs to look at the whole tithing and giving issue. So I don't believe that tithing is taught anywhere in the New Testament. Jesus didn't teach it to the disciples. The apostles didn't teach it. And the idea that you have to give to your local church is entirely extra biblical, since what we call a local church has no parallels in the Bible. I appreciate your call, June. I need to try to take another call. I'm almost out of time here. Raylene from Honolulu, Hawaii.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, but you're going to have to speak quickly because we're almost out of time.
Okay. I got so much things to tell you, but anyways, I've been through so much in my life, and I could see when I was very young, because I got bit by the dog. Ever since then, growing up, I could see and I could feel. I'm like different from everybody. Like, I was wish that people could tell me what was different. At the darkest hurting time, like a suicide happened, and they blame me and stuff. I had a cross with Jesus behind me, and I was like a month sitting down, and no one could talk to me, and I didn't talk to anybody, but I felt so empty. But one day I said, I'm all alone, and his voice came from like above, was so deep and low. You're not alone. What was that? So I jumped up and started crying because you're right. I was sitting in front of the cross.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to leave it there because we're out of time for the program, but sounds like a dynamic experience. Thank you for sharing it with us. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener supported. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730. Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to thenarrowpath.com. Our website, everything is free there, but you can donate there at thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you. Thanks for joining us.